It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Front One.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, October 16th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live-ish in the metaphorical, no, in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building. In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, no internet. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Our internet went out. So we're recording this with the hopes that someday the internet will return to us. And we'll be able to post this online as a podcast. Now, for literally thousands upon thousands of you, it's nothing new. Nothing different about this. But for us, maybe we feel it. I don't know what it is. It's strange.
I feel like we were just playing pretend.
I feel like we're in some type of post-apocalyptic world where we have no internet, but only recording devices and the capacity to post podcasts later in the day. After the huge cyber attack from the Iranians, who are attempting to take out our internet service, but not our podcast service. That, of course, is a reference to the recent wave of stupid stories.
If they must listen, it surely will not be live.
That's right. We will debilitate the Americans' ability to listen to Sam Cedar live and then just watch as their society crumbles. Folks, great time to say to you, become a member of the Majority Report at majority.fm. It is your support which makes this show possible and allows for things like the extra $100 a month it would be to get another business service internet provider in here so that this never, ever happens again. So become a member today at majority.fm. Now, folks, you will recall, of course, today is the debate day. I don't know if this is the biggest debate of the season, but it could very well be. Certainly, the corporate media will treat it as such. To the extent that you think that the polling has turned significantly or dramatically in Romney's favor, this is a big day. I'm not quite so sure, but I did mention a couple of weeks ago when I was on Up with Chris, I guess now it was a month ago, we were talking about poverty, and I made the point, which keeps coming up, of course, because I was both aware of what was happening and prescient, as I often am, that the Republicans were only using the poor and poverty as some type of prop. And to the extent that they were, it was a prop cudgel. And as if Paul Ryan felt it was his number one job to make me look correct. And not just correct, but exquisitely correct. Paul Ryan yesterday in Ohio trying to show how compassionate he is, how in touch with the poor he is. Has his campaign stopped? I guess, were they in Youngstown or were they on the way to Youngstown? As reported by CBS, he stopped at the Mahoning County St. Vincent de Paul Society, and which is a charity in Ohio, a soup kitchen. And they decide to go in. Now, look, I'm not a child. I understand that when politicians do anything, they're doing it for the photo opportunity. And the calculation they make is we get to spend a couple hours here. We'll get a couple of photos. Maybe we'll also, and, you know, when I'm not at my most cynical, I think that they feel, well, we're going to turn the country's attention to this. You know, there was a time like a guy like Robert Kennedy took a poverty tour and actually went and learned things. Co-host Bobby Kennedy on Ring of Fire speaks about this. And as a child, he was there and he still talks about to this day, 45 years later, what he learned on that tour. Compare and contrast to Paul Ryan showing up with his kids at this soup kitchen in Ohio. Unannounced, uninvited. So much so that the president of the society told the Washington Post, "We're a faith-based organization. We are apolitical because the majority of our funding is from private donations. It's strictly in our bylaws not to do it. They showed up here. They did not have permission. They got one of the volunteers to open the doors. The photo op they did wasn't even accurate." Paul Ryan walks in, and you can watch this video in just a second. He walks in, he puts aprons on his kid and on himself. I guess it's no big deal, but he doesn't know that you actually tie them in the front because they're supposed to wrap around, whatever. Maybe this is the first time he put on an apron. You know, he's just used to wearing muscle shirts and working out. He looks around for a pan. He says, "Oh, I'll take this one. It was already cleaned." Sprayed some water on it and said, "I'll let you guys dry it." In the words of the president of this charitable society, he just came in here to get his picture taken at the dining hall. He did nothing. He was there for 15 minutes. Just think for a moment, what's the lesson you're teaching your kids? I mean, honestly, like, aren't you embarrassed to show your kids this? Like, let me show you what poverty's all about. Go in, put the apron on, shush, 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 let's go. I would at least say to the kids, you know what? Stay in the bus, because I don't want to have you see how craven and despicable your dad can be at times. You know, even in even in pursuit of some higher goal or agenda. I'd be embarrassed. I would be literally embarrassed to have my kids see me do this. At least let them have the delusion of, like, dad's going into a charity. He's a great guy. And let them, at least in their imagination, they could never come up with that's how little effort you put into in that situation. Let them have the delusion, at least. Watch this tape and tell me if you don't throw up a little bit in your mouth.
I'm gonna water them. I'm gonna get them wet, and you guys are gonna have to dry them. You know, I spent a summer washing dishes. We had a Hobart that was. You get calluses on your fingers because it's so hot. Oh, yeah, this one. Hey, buddy. Is there a brush?
Oh, here we go. What's that?
You want to use the little scrubby? Hey, you got one.
I got one of these. Yeah.
That's what we use. Yeah. This is like the sausage thing and stuff like that. Yeah. Okay, so here's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna spray it.
This is my favorite part here because he's turning the pan away from the camera where he knows it is because there's nothing on the pan. It's already been cleaned. So he's just like, oh, look at how dirty this is. I got to wash this. And don't forget, kids, got to rinse the soap off. I don't know if the point is the kids have never washed the dish before or watched him, or he's just like, I'm teaching the kids how to wash a clean pan. Unbelievable.
Make sure all the soap's in. Get it in the bottom one more time. I'm going to rinse these. Sam, Eliza, go ahead and hold it. Don't drop it.
No, you need another one.
So when they left, though the pictures taken shows Ryan apparently doing dishes, the food had already been served and everything had already been cleaned before he got there. Had they asked for permission, said again the president of this charitable organization, it wouldn't have been granted. But I certainly wouldn't have let him wash clean pans and then take a picture. Unbelievable. Just unbelievable. Meanwhile, moving on to other business. Well, let's take a quick musical break. We'll be back in just a sec. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Why not pick up friend of show Sarah Silverman's memoir, The Bedwetter, Stories of Courage, Redemption, and Pee. It's not for everybody, but Sarah is a friend of the show, old friend of mine. The book is very funny. Pick it up. Get it for free. audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Get it now. So, as reported yesterday in the New York Times, the American Civil Liberties Union is suing Morgan Stanley for the predatory loans that were made by the New Century Financial Corporation, which was a mortgage originator, because of the investment that the bank lent, billions of dollars to New Century. It is now, of course, in bankruptcy, and it pressured New Century to make these crappy loans, because of course they needed essentially product to put into these securitized financial instruments that they could turn around and sell. And these loans that New Century made were basically, in many cases, what is known as liar loans, and specifically targeted at low-income African-American families. And the ACLU has filed suit claiming that Morgan Stanley violated the Fair Housing Act and the Equal Credit Opportunity Act in actually targeting people that they anticipated, this would be New Century, anticipated would have a high degree of financial illiteracy, knowing all the while that these loans were crappy loans, and then turning them around and selling them in these big packages as investment opportunities. Robbie McCoy, one of the five named plaintiffs in the lawsuit, took out a loan from New Century in 2006 with an adjustable rate starting at 12.14%. Now, I can tell you, I got a mortgage in 2005 at 6.25. So they target people that they know have bad credit. They put them in a subprime loan at twice the going rate of any other loans, making it an adjustable rate, which probably means actually that it's even more than twice the adjustable, twice the going rate, because mine was a 30-year fixed. The rate could not fall below 10.75%. It came with excessive fees and costs, according to the suit. McCoy was a single mother. She couldn't afford the payments, but the broker told her to lie on her income to get a house. She said, having a house was a way to keep my kids grounded, she said. She's a Detroit citizen. And so what you have here is you have a mortgage originator pressured by Morgan Stanley, which has invested a ton of cash into this company, telling them basically, like, look, we want product. Give us product. We don't care what these mortgages look like. The mortgage originator goes out and finds the most financially illiterate, most desperate people in the country, sells them these loans, tells them, hey, I'm a professional. Don't worry about putting your income down. Don't worry about this. 50% of your income, that's the average. To pay for a house, that's the average. Now, remember, Morgan Stanley was pressured by Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley for its packaging of New Century mortgage loans. In 2010, the bank agreed under threat of suit to pay $102 million to close an investigation by the Attorney General of Massachusetts. At that time, Coakley said the bank ignored warning signs about the quality of New Century's loans and tried to court the lender's business by lowering its loan standards. Look, these people are professionals, theoretically. That's what banks do. That's why they have loan officers. They have a fiduciary responsibility, not just to their shareholders as a bank, but also to the extent that they are federally insured. And certainly to the extent that they are backstopped by the federal government, whether it's the Fed opens up the discount window at 0% interest, or they get bailouts from Treasury. The subprime loans cited in the suit were made from 2004 to 2007. New Century, one of the country's most prolific subprime lenders, went bankrupt in 2007. New Century was responsible for the greatest share of loans in foreclosure in the 10 metropolitan areas blighted by the highest foreclosure rates. What a coincidence. A former employee who testified in a separate civil suit against Morgan Stanley said that the bank officials knowingly bought loans in which borrowers' debt levels were more than 50% of their total income. The bank, according to one former employee, typically did not require New Century to conduct a second appraisal of homes, fearing that the second look would result in lower assessment and prevent the loans from being securitized. In other words, all of the internal backstop measures, all of the internal regulations to prevent these things from happening were essentially waived so that they could happen. African Americans living in Detroit area were 70% more likely to wind up with a subprime loan than were white borrowers with similar financial characteristics. This according to an analysis contained in the lawsuit of New Century loans made between 2004 and 2006. So they were preying on African American communities because they, I suspect, believed that there was a wider financial illiteracy than there were in white communities with the same financial background in terms of what their income was, what their debt levels were. And I think the theory was, if we go into these blighted areas, much less likely that somebody has a cousin or a relative or a friend who lives across town who can say, hey, wait a second, this doesn't seem right. The Justice Department has accused two major banks of discriminating against black and Hispanic customers. A settlement in one case was announced in July when Wells Fargo agreed to pay $175 million to settle claims that the bank steered roughly 34,000 minority customers into subprime mortgages, even though they could have qualified for mortgages with lower fees and less risks. For Ms. McCoy, the $79,000 loan that allowed her to buy a home in 2006 quickly turned into an albatross. She struggled to pay the monthly amount, which at the time consumed more than her half of her monthly income. She's got three kids. She's a single parent. She is four kids. Trying to keep them off the street. Figures the only way to do this is to buy a home. Professionals sit her down and tell her, don't worry. This is what happens all the time. Don't worry about a thing. Suck more fees out of her. Give her an inflated rate so that they get more fees out of it. And everybody along the line makes money. And in the end, she just gets screwed. And then you get a piece like this from Adam Ross Sorkin today in the New York Times. Well, I guess this is yesterday. I don't really know how to characterize this piece other than saying if Andrew Ross Sorkin was working in the PR department of some trade organization that represented these investment banks, Morgan Stanley, Wells Fargo, he couldn't have done a better job. Nowadays, Wall Street saviors may wish they weren't. They may wish they weren't Wall Street saviors. Try and guess who the Wall Street saviors are. Is it the U.S. taxpayer? Is it the government that is loaning money to these banks at 0% interest? Is it the ones who are not frog marching these people? No. Jamie Dimon, an asked almost almost rhetorically the other last week at the Council of Foreign Relations in Washington, asked, would I have done Bear Stearns knowing knowing what I know today? It's really close. Wow. Shed a tear for this guy. Some of the strongest firms during the crisis that acquired failing banks at the behest of the government forced them to do it. And by government, what we're talking about is former Goldman Sachs banker Henry Paulson. We're all talking about former investment bank executives. The government. JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, among them, have found themselves in the crosshairs of lawsuits brought by the government for activities related to deals they made under pressure from authorities. Really, pressure from authorities. And then, the graphs in this paragraph, in this piece are just stunning. Whether you love or hate Wall Street, so I'm bringing you all, this is what's called bring the audience into the circle. So now we are all on the same side. Whether you love or hate Wall Street, everybody, we're here. Whether you want bankers to go to jail or not, well, everybody, come on. The recent series of suits brought by the government may have a profound impact on how businesses react to being asked to provide assistance when the next financial crisis arrives. I feel like there could be entire departments of universities that could give graduate study courses on that sentence. Listen carefully. I'm going to say this again. I mean, I wish if this entire program was on video, I would spend an hour just putting this sentence up on a screen so that you could read it. Whether you love or hate Wall Street, whether you want bankers to go to jail or not, the recent series of suits brought by the government may have a profound impact on how businesses react to being asked to provide assistance when the next financial crisis arrives. So somehow what he's saying is that despite any of your opinions about what went on, this might affect their interest, their willingness. We won't even go that far. It might have a big impact on how businesses react. So, in other words, this massive financial crisis might have an impact on how businesses, i.e. investment banks, because those are the only businesses we're talking about here, might react if the government comes a-calling and begging for them to take the government money. Yeah, it might. And chances are they won't. Now, I want you to think about this as we walk through this. Because he mentions that Schneiderman's lawsuit claiming that J.P. Morgan Chase misrepresented and defrauded investors of certain mortgage securities. Damages are estimated high as $3 billion. The only problem is that multiple and fraudulent deceptive acts that the government alleged didn't take place at J.P. Morgan Chase. They happened at Bear Stearns during 2005 to 2007. Now, are we to believe that no one at J.P. Morgan Chase thought that there was anything wrong with Bear Stearns? We didn't know we had to accept liability. Now, of course, you have to go well deep into the piece to get to this graph. It's hard to believe that J.P. Morgan didn't come out ahead, or at least close to even, on the acquisition, given that Bear's 43-story headquarters on Madison Avenue was part of the deal. So in other words, even with this liability, everybody believes J.P. Morgan still going to come out ahead. Just on this deal. He goes on, if you ran a company Again, a company, as opposed to an investment bank. Would you help participate in a bailout if you thought there was a chance the government might turn around and sue you later for the misdeeds of the company you're helping to save? Well, let's rephrase that question. Wasn't the whole point of all that we've been told? Hasn't Aaron Ross Sorkin written at least one piece saying we needed these bailouts or the entire financial system would have crashed? Would not J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America crashed if none of this happened? So, in other words, there was some self-interest, aside from the fact that he already admits they've probably come out ahead on this anyways. There was also just survival at stake. Isn't that the whole point of all of this? Or have we forgotten that now? We were told, this is Armageddon. If you were a business, would you do this in the future? Well, if we're faced with financial Armageddon, why wouldn't I? Aside from the fact that I've already profited from this.
Well, and maybe now you could extract more promises, like we don't want to be held accountable for any liabilities. Maybe that would be the distinction in the future.
In fact, what I would say is, well, we have another financial Armageddon that we have been, at the very least, encouraging, because I don't think Wells Fargo and Bank of America or J.P. Morgan Chase is without fault in any of this. They're just going to go, I don't know if you remember this Aaron Ross Sorkin piece, but maybe we're going to have to get retroactive immunity, or the next contract's going to have to be we don't accept any liability. And it goes on to say, to question the whole notion of none of this is to suggest that the government should not hold those responsible for fraud or other misconduct accountable. But few of the lawsuits that the government has brought against the banks have anything to do with the culpability of those individuals who were actually responsible for the problems. Instead, the government is simply holding responsible the company's shareholders who were unlikely to have been shareholders at the time of the misdeeds. Does this really offer a deterrent effect, or is this just a nice way to garner headlines ahead of an election? Well, it might be a nice way to garner headlines ahead of an election, but there's a fundamental problem if government can't sue banks because we don't know if it's all the same shareholders. Because officials at corporations change. Corporations are not people. You can't. The executives are responsible, as usual, pay nothing. If there were, quote, deceptive acts, the government could and should bring cases, if not criminal, then civil, against the individuals. Can you imagine the day that that happens? What the Aaron Ross Sorkin piece would be? Fraud isn't something a company does. It's something people do. Wow. From your mouth to God's ears, that corporations are not people. I just... Unbelievable.
I will forever and always remember Andrew Ross Sorkin as the brilliant man who penned that brilliant piece around this time last year about how I went down to Occupy Wall Street to check it out.
The point that he went down to Occupy Wall Street is because individual bank officers called him.
I think it was actually a bank CEO.
Yes, and said, do I have something to worry about? Now, of course, at that time, the idea of holding any of these individuals responsible for this is completely out of bounds. That's crazy. These are businesses. You can't hold the individuals responsible for this stuff. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And speaking of holding individuals accountable, that doesn't happen in our society either.
You know, Andrew Ross Sorkin can write about how it's people who cause fraud. You don't charge corporations with being fraudulent. It's not fair to some shareholders. They didn't know that when they bought J.P. Morgan Chase that they had bought Bear Stearns, that Bear Stearns had done things that might be problematic. Apparently, none of these brilliant masters of the universe are aware that you assume certain liabilities. If I buy a house that has Superfund cleanup, I got to deal with that problem. Now, I might be able to sue the people before that, but what if they're the company that dumped that stuff there years ago, no longer around? Well, of course, the government comes in. But speaking of a lack of accountability, you all remember back in March, it's a story, according to Bloomberg, that a former Morgan Stanley banker, William Brian Jennings, was the former head of the bond underwriting, after the Christmas party got a cab in Midtown and wanted to be driven to his home in Darien, Connecticut. And depending on whose story you believe, Mr. Amar, the cab driver, said that Mr. Jennings refused to pay the fare of $204 and told the cabbie, "I'm going to kill you. You should go back to your country." And stabbed him in the hand with a 2.5-inch blade during a roadside altercation. Mr. Jennings said that the driver demanded $294 and then started driving the banker back to New York City when he refused to pay. All charges, including a larceny charge over the unpaid fare, will be dropped on Monday, according to Reuters this past week. Nobody's quite clear as to why these charges are being dropped. Mr. Amar's attorney said that they had received indication that the trial was moving forward. They never heard a reason why. And there doesn't seem to be any account that would justify why the guy got stabbed with a knife. I mean, whether it's you charged me $204 or you charged me $294. He started to drive me back to New York. He left me off in the middle of nowhere. For some reason, apparently, one of those stories, depending on whose you believe, allows you to stab someone in the hand if they're just a cab driver and you're a former Morgan Stanley executive. Wonderful. Wonderful. Let's do a little bit of debate prep for tonight. We're going to be doing a live debate show starting at, I don't know, minutes before the debate, I guess, right? And we will also make that available for members. Tomorrow on the program, Digby will be joining us to do a debate wrap-up. Thursday on the program, Christia Freeland will be here. Talk about, I guess, what was an excerpt in the New York Times Review of Books on her latest book. She does some great reporting on these billionaire crybabies. I mean, I don't know. Whiners. Well, I guess we're good. We were out of time, right? We'll go in and do the rest of this debate prep for the members. We run in a couple minutes. So we got a couple more minutes.
We're at 36 minutes right
okay.
now.
Okay. All right. We'll do a couple more debate prep because members are going to get that debate stuff too. But going into the debate tonight, President Obama is going to have to draw some fairly bright lines somewhere. Now, remember, he's already taken Social Security off the table for some ungodly known reason. right? We don't really have much differences on Social Security. Now, I suppose he could talk about it, and then Romney could say, hey, I thought you said we didn't have much differences on Social Security. And then Obama could say, well, I had some experts look into your plans. Now, I thought we didn't have differences, but that's because you don't make anything that you're standing for clear, or whatever. Do I expect him to do that? Highly doubtful. Huge, huge, huge mistake. I mean, you've just basically taken a massive arrow out of your quiver. So we may hear more about the 47%. And just to put that in context, you all know that 47% represents the number of people who do not pay any federal income tax, either because they're a senior citizen, either because they're a family of four that has a series of deductions and doesn't make more than $50,000 or $60,000 a year, either because they're a vet or they're disabled, mostly because their income just doesn't reach a threshold. As part of earned income tax credits that were passed by Republicans. Piece by Bruce Watson at the Daily Finance from AOL. When measured properly, including Medicare and Social Security taxes, 86% of taxpayers pay into the federal system. 86%. The remaining 14% are either retired elderly people or students and disabled. So everybody else essentially pays. Everybody else pays some type of federal tax. The poorest 20% of workers pay a far larger percent of their income in Social Security tax than the richest 20%. But the real place where poor people take a hit is in state taxes. In the median state, Mississippi, the poorest 20% of workers pay almost twice as high a percentage of their income as the richest 1%. In Washington state, they pay 17.3% of their income, more than six times as much as the top 1%. Because this is where you get really hit with sales taxes. So when you hear people say, like, we should just go to one big sales tax on everything, understand that the poor spend most of their paychecks on necessities. Because they don't have the capacity to go out and buy luxuries. They're living week to week on their paychecks. They're spending all of their money on food, shelter, clothing. And they're not investing it. They're not saving it. They're expending it on things that they're going to have to pay sales tax. So they pay a much higher percentage in sales taxes to their income than the wealthy do. There's just not enough yachts and carpeted sinks and, you know, $200,000 cars for the wealthy to pay to make it up in their sales tax. So keep that in mind tonight during the debate. We're going to head into the better half of the program. And really, I don't know, this is a fascinating piece to me by Ezra Klein. And I have a couple of theories on it, but it is very nice to see a guy who I perceive who drives the conventional wisdom, who is often a product of the conventional wisdom. I mean, I think he's center-left-ish, but by his own accord, he's not a liberal. He's a wonk. And, well, we'll talk more about this in the better half of the program. But a very interesting piece that I think is going to have long-term impact. Perhaps. That's me knocking on wood. Folks, it's your support that makes this program possible. Please become a member at majority.fm. Seriously, we really do need to up the number of members. There's thousands of you who listen to this show either on a daily basis or a couple of times a week or once a week or maybe more during periods of intense political activity. But if you want the show to be here so that you can dip in every once in a while, you got to support it. That's just the way it is. Otherwise, you're stuck with the corporate media that will either cheerlead or simply boo or really promote an agenda of the establishment in this country. And you may disagree or agree with my opinions from time to time, but you can know that I have no boss that is telling me what to do. And I don't fear being fired by anyone if I do something that offends any given interest. And it's your support that allows me to maintain that independence. You can also support this program by going to justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, buying your junk through our Amazon link at majority.fm/support the show. You see the Amazon button, you click it, bookmark it, give us a review on iTunes, buy some merch. Join us tonight for the debate. We'll stream the debate. I won't talk too much during it.
The internet should surely be up by then.
I'm hoping. And see you in the better half.
Say it's an apple pay.